This is Chick Flick Fix. I'm Julia Scott.
And I'm AJ Knox.
We watch chick flicks and rom-coms and decide if they need fixing. Can we make them better or can we make them weird? And you can support us either on Patreon or at theincomparable.com by becoming a member. This week, we're talking about The Proposal from 2009. This is the last movie in our Sanctuary series, but most definitely not our last Sandra Bullock discussion.
Oh, definitely not.
It's directed by Anne Fletcher and written by Peter Chiarelli, and it stars Sandra Bullock, Ryan Reynolds, Betty White, and Mary Steenburgen. Anne Fletcher also directed Step Up, 27 Dresses, and Dumplin'.
Huh, that's a interesting mix. And also, 27 Dresses?
Mm-hmm.
That's so bad. But this is good.
So Julia Roberts was the first choice to play Margaret here, but apparently she didn't want to take a pay cut, so Sandra Bullock took over. And Julia Roberts was also offered a leading role in The Blind Side in the same year, which she turned down. Sandra Bullock took it and won a Best Actress Oscar.
Huh. I'm trying to picture her in this. And, like, weirdly, I know a lot of people think that they're kind of interchangeable rom-com leads, but I can't see her in this. My wife just watched Ocean's 11. So, and then I remembered in the sequel, they have her... They like
playing her. Yeah, she's playing herself, but
Not herself. Oh, it gets so weird.
Yeah. And then Sandra Bullock is in Ocean's 8.
Oh, that's right.
Betty White almost turned down this role because filming would require her to spend 10 weeks away from her golden retriever.
Oh, my God.
Which is the best Betty White reason of all. I remember a couple of weeks ago when Betty White was trending and everyone goes, but it was because it was her birthday. Which is funny because, you know, she's 90 in this movie.
And that was like spot on for age, right? Because she's 99 right now.
She's 99 now, so she would have been maybe like 88.
88? Or something. So, I mean, pretty close.
Yeah. I hope she got to bring her golden retriever.
Oh, yeah.
So, a really fun piece of trivia. Ryan Reynolds' last name in this movie is Paxton, and it's set, if not filmed, in Sitka, in Alaska. And as of 2018, the mayor of Sitka is Gary Paxton.
Huh.
Which I think is kind of sweet. I don't know why I think that. And actually, speaking of the golden retriever, the weird fluffy teddy bear dog is played by four different dogs of the breed that's called Alaskan Eskimo. And I was like, can you still call a dog that? And I actually looked it up, that the word Eskimo is not necessarily considered a slur, but it's usually not a preferred term by a lot of Inuit people, both in Alaska and Greenland and Canada and other parts of the world. But there are some organizations that still use it. And for a time, I think it was thought to come from a word that meant raw meat eater, but it apparently comes from, linguists think, a word that means netter of snowshoes, which I think is kind of cool either way. It's kind of like how the word Indian has gone kind of back and forth within Native American organizations. I'll link to a video by CGP Grey about the word Indian and why there's no like super easy way to decide.
Well, Alaska has a really interesting relationship with the Inuit population. I used to go to a theater conference in Alaska every summer, which would have been like right around this time where it's like light all the time. And one year, this group of performers did like a Mystery Science Theater thing with a bear and a crow and a human trapped in a cabin having to watch Alaska movies. And one of the movies they watched was like this weird movie about, it was like a very problematic old movie about this, I think, Inuit woman who falls in love with a white man or something. But in the movie, all the speaking roles for the Native population were played by Italians.
Classic.
And all the actual Native performers in the film are like background extras. And even there's like one scene where somebody buys birthday candles at a little shop and then puts them on the cake and then eats the candle. It's like a weird background thing. And I'm like, oof, this is problematic.
Like, is that a SAG thing or just racist?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, I think it's really interesting because sometimes you're like, ooh, I have this feeling that that's not a word you're supposed to use. Mm-hmm. But I also had a feeling there was one of those words where you can't you can't go yes or no. I think it's interesting. And there's a lot of interesting history about the Inuit and Yupik people. I thought this was also relevant to bring up because you do get some like native history and representation here in that Betty White comes from a, like, because first you're like, oh no, why is she doing this weird, yeah, like white woman spiritual dancing around a fire thing? But then it turns out that she actually does have, I'm assuming, Native Alaskan blood. I don't know enough about the different parts of the Yupik and Inuit.
I think that is what is suggested.
And I'm like, I want to watch this movie, you know, of the... Anyway, had you seen this before?
I have seen this before a couple times. And ironically, ironically is probably the wrong word. Interestingly enough, my wife loves watching these with me because she's like, yeah, you get to watch these movies, Adela. She had never seen this.
That's fun.
So this was the first time I got to watch a movie with her that I had seen that she had not. For this podcast.
I saw this when it came out. I'm pretty sure it might have been like a year or two later. I don't think I've seen this more than once, but I still remember the windows to the walls, sweat drop down my balls.
I had forgotten scene. About that part. I had forgotten all about the native stuff.
I don't think I remembered that it was part. I was like, in the woods, they sing that and I don't remember why.
Yeah.
And it's funny because we've had, I think, at least two or three people get in contact and be like, are you going to do the proposal? And I think it's one of those like forgotten but remembered movies, which I think is kind of interesting. And I feel like it's funny too, because in some ways it's a pretty big parallel to 2 Weeks Notice, which we just talked about.
Right.
But it also has a lot of parallels with While You Were Sleeping, because you have like fake relationship. It ends with a wedding. And like discovering that family is great. Sandra Bullock plays this woman without a family, that whole thing.
And son-in-law.
Yes.
This
that
is
too.
Basically like, a grafted version of son-in-law with role reversals.
But this is, and I mean, obviously we'll get into it, but this movie fascinates me because the stakes are high for a fluffy movie. Yeah. It's a very fluffy little movie, but the stakes are 5 years in prison and a fine of up to $250,000.
Yeah.
Which is not, you know, it's not like, oh, this will be embarrassing or I'll lose this promotion. It's big time, but the movie itself is so fluffy.
Yeah.
Okay, what is this movie about?
Oh, come on!
Good morning, Miss Tate.
I need you around this weekend. You have a problem with that?
No, I just, my grandmother's 90th birthday, so I was going to go home, and it's fine. I'll cancel it.
Is that your family?
Yes.
They tell you to quit?
Every single day. Margaret Tate's office.
This isn't about my second raise, is it?
Margaret, your visa application is denied. You're being deported.
Deported? It's not like I'm an immigrant or something. I'm from Canada.
If you're deported, you can't work for an American company.
If there was any way at all that we could make this thing work.
Pardon the interruption.
I understand the predicament, but there is something that you should know. We are, we're getting married.
Who is getting married?
You and I. You and I are getting married. Yes.
We are.
Getting married.
We are getting married.
Yes.
All right. So, we meet, Ryan Reynolds as he is running, well, his name is Andrew. I should know that because, my name is Andrew. Ryan Reynolds, Andrew, is running across the street holding two empty cups of coffee. This is like one of my biggest pet peeves. I'm like, those clearly have no coffee in them. Well, he spills it on one of the employees when he gets into the office. But like when he's running and when he like gets onto the elevator, he like, it looks like kind of a mistake. He like elbow checks himself into the elevator door as it's shutting with the arm that's holding these two coffees kind of both askew. I was like, oh, those coffees would be done. So he's running through Manhattan, getting into his office, and he spills one of his coffees on one of the coworkers when he gets into the office, and then his boss shows up, and it's Sandra Bullock as Margaret Tate.
And the only thing that's missing here is like the Wicked Witch of the West music that they used in Ally
McBeal.
When Lucy Liu shows up, everyone is afraid.
Yeah, everyone's terrified of her. As soon as she gets to the office, everyone has, like, the company-wide instant message where it's, like, the witch is on her broom and, you know, all these little, like, code languages.
Coming.
Yeah, it starts with it's coming or it's here or something like that. And I'm like, oh, she's a movie monster. And everyone stops goofing off and starts pretending to work really hard.
But we never actually see anything that hints at how.
Right.
Like, why we get, like, it's, you know, it's a classic, like, she had to probably be really harsh to make it to where she is. But she's never actually rude or harsh to anyone.
Well, she's like, harsh to Bob.
She's harsh to Bob, but it's she's not harsh to Bob until he bitches her out.
Right.
Before that, she's very nice about it. She's like, I'll let it look like you resigned, you know. And she's vaguely harsh to Andrew, but she's more like dismissive of him because he's an assistant in a way that doesn't feel super rude. Where I'm like, just, you know, put in something about she made someone cry, anything, because otherwise it just feels like misogyny.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But yeah, so she gets to work. Andrew is her assistant. She's drinking her coffee. She notices there's a little phone number on the coffee from the barista. And she tastes, she asks, and he goes, oh, that must be my coffee. And she tastes it, and it's her coffee order. And she's like, what? So you drink this too? And he goes, no, I definitely don't order. Cinnamon,
something, something.
Yeah, it's like some complicated frou-frou-y kind of drink. And he's like, no, I definitely.
Everyone is allowed cinnamon.
Right. And he's like, no, I definitely don't order two of the same thing in case I spill one of them. Which I, like, I don't know why I loved that little touch of, like, he orders himself what she gets just in case her spills.
Which was very good assistanting.
Yeah. Ingenious, but also, like, you get right off the bat, he's self-sacrificing.
Or just extremely practical. But again, like, we need to know, is she scary or is he a very good assistant? Because both of them can be true, but it could be, like, he could be a bad assistant, but just so completely downtrodden that he'll do anything to avoid being yelled at. I feel that it's more that he's a good assistant, but they kind of try to play it both. And I will say here, you know, every movie, almost, at least half of them, I'm like, age difference.
Yeah.
But here you do have, at least Ryan Reynolds is, like, in his mid-30s. And there is a definite difference of, like, early 30s to early 40s. Rather than, like, 25 and 38.
Right.
Like, they are both established people. And on top of that, you know, there is a slight shift in the power balance when the woman is the one who is older and in charge. And then there's a bunch of other ickiness about power structures on the whole. But it's very hypocritical of me to be like, I like that she's the older one and the one with the power, when usually I'm all against that. But I'm a hypocritical feminist, and I'll live with that.
Well, I have, like, a weird, interesting theory that, like, I wonder if this movie started out in its initial drafts, maybe, with gender reversal, and it got doctored, or you know, it got...
Like, while you were sleeping?
Yeah, and it was like, and it was like, he was the boss, and she was the assistant, and somebody... It's kind of unusual to see this power structure in a movie. We don't see a lot of it.
I feel like this would have been the original script, just because so many of the things don't work, like, have to be completely changed, I think. And I think it's intentionally written to be like, hey, it is less creepy if it's not a man forcing his younger female assistant to marry him, also bringing him to somewhere where they're going to have to share a room. Right. All of this stuff is going to be way creepier. And... yeah. But, like, I mean, I have, straight off the bat, like, again, I think there are a lot of brutal stakes here, and there are some things that I don't really appreciate the structure of, but I am a sucker in romance for, you know, the tropes of fake relationship, and, oh no, there's only one bed. Here, they don't actually share the bed, but it is, right. I don't know, it's just, it's such a corny, stupid trope, but I'm all about it. And, like, he sleeps on the floor on the baby maker.
Well, we haven't even gotten there yet.
I'm sorry.
So we meet her. She fires Asif Manvi's character, Bob, for not getting one of her clients. Oh, I should say, it's a book publishing company. And so she fires basically, like, the person who would be next, the next most powerful person, it seems, in the office, for not getting somebody on Oprah. And right after she does that, as you mentioned, he kind of bitches her out, and she shuts him down in front of everybody, and it's really intense. It's like, oh, all right, she's
very
powerful.
Very satisfying.
Yeah.
Because, again, I feel like she doesn't get harsh and personal until after he... And you see, because she even, like, she mouths to herself, like, don't go there, Bob.
Don't do it.
And then she does it, which it's a good scene, I think. It's a well-written...
It's the Bugs Bunny rule. It's the Bugs Bunny rule. Bugs Bunny doesn't start fights. He only responds to them.
He ends them.
Yeah, well, because otherwise he's a bully, right?
Yeah.
So, Margaret gets called up to her higher-up's office, and they tell her that because she neglected to file her immigration paperwork, she's about to be deported.
And we have a scene that's kind of, you know, you've seen before of the powerful person trying to push back something important.
Yeah.
Kind of like in Sweet November. It's like,
oh,
even
yeah.
you can't escape the INS.
The DMV. Yeah, exactly. So just then, Andrew comes in and he says, hey, he mentions the word engagement. Something like, should
you're
I say
otherwise engaged.
Yeah, otherwise, should I tell, somebody's on the phone, should I tell them you're otherwise engaged? And she goes, light bulb. And she's like, this is my fiance, Andrew. We're getting married. Does everything work? Everything kosher? Cool. There's a couple little jokes about her higher-ups and their secretaries and how icky that would be.
That they've already done
and
it and they don't have a foot to stand on.
Yeah, they can't argue with her because they're also doing inappropriate workplace stuff. Which they really brush over quickly. But anyway, so they head to immigration services, and she cuts the line in a way I thought, oh, she's, you know, wealthy white lady cutting this line full of mostly black and brown people. She's going to, like, they're going to shut her down. And no, they bring her right, and I was like, they bring her right back to, like, to the offices. And I'm like, oh, I wish she didn't cut the line. Like, I just, that privileged moment. Irked me.
But unfortunately, like, I don't know if that would literally work at the little INS, but unfortunately it does work a lot. Like, that I just have to do this one thing. Oh, oops, here are all my clothes on the counter now.
Yeah. And so they go back to meet with their agent who will be handling her case, and he immediately calls them on a fake engagement. He goes, this wouldn't be because you're about to be deported, right? And you're going to lose your high-paying job. And turns out Bob ratted them out. And she's like, no. And he goes, all right, well, here's the deal. You are, I'm going to investigate your lives. And if I find anything wrong, you're going to prison and getting a fine. And to Andrew and to Margaret, you're getting deported. So, the stakes are crazy high. And Andrew is basically leverages that and says, all right, you want high stakes? Here's the deal. We do this, we're going to go visit my family because I want to go home and you won't let me. I never get vacation. And once this is all done, you're going to make me editor.
Which is a promotion that he seems to have been in line for a while.
Yeah, he's been trying to get that and it's just taken a long time. And you're going to publish my manuscript. So she's like, fine. So
and I think it should be, I think, clarified too that she doesn't mean a book that he has written. It's a book that he's been trying to push for getting published.
Right.
It's this thing that's he has discovered a book in the so-called slush pile, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Or I mean it might have been left on his pillow, I don't know. And she has been saying no to it, and he's like, you're gonna put this through this thing that I found.
Yeah.
Because I do kind of love the idea that he just has this, I guess, really crappy kids book or something. He's like,
right,
I want my book about the angry little caterpillar.
Yeah. And so In kind of one of the movie's core kind of tropes, as he's talking about where they're going to visit his family, it turns out to be Sitka, Alaska, which is much further away than she had anticipated. So all these things kind of keep catching her off guard, which is kind of fun.
And I really, speaking of son-in-law, I really appreciate the conceit that she's like, all right, we're going to Hickville, I guess.
Yeah.
And no, they are not just old money, they are... you know, town royalty. They are very, because she's expecting like, oh crap, I'm gonna have to stay like in the guest room of this, you know, rickety rundown shack or whatever it is she's picturing. And it turns out that no, he is what did she call him, Alaskan Kennedy?
Yeah, something like that. And she's like, you never said you were rich. He goes, I'm not rich, my family's rich.
No, my parents are rich.
My parents are rich, yeah.
And she goes, that's what rich people say.
And I do like the idea of, like, flying there, and you have to take, like, a second plane to get there, because where I used to go in Valdez, you would fly into Anchorage and then have to take this little tiny plane flying over glaciers. It's beautiful, but also... And she's got all this Louis Vuitton luggage that, of course, gets tossed in the water and dragged along the rocks and stuff like that.
And he is really, throughout both the trip and then the first, like, day and a half or something, he is really taking the opportunity to be an ass to her.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he's just, it's not just that he's like, we have to act like, you know, we're engaged, so I won't be trodden upon. He is really taking every chance.
Well, because he has the power now.
Mm-hmm.
This is, so, the quick tangent. One of my favorite theater games is from this guy called Augusto Boal, and he does this thing called Theater for the Oppressed, or he did. He's passed away. And it's about how using theater and games, he worked in Brazil primarily, and using theater and games to, like, help oppress people kind of discover ways to take power and assert themselves. Really badass guy. But one of his games is called Colombian Hypnosis, and basically all it is you hold your hand up to your partner's... All his games have, like, weird names. You hold your hand up to about a foot away from your partner's face, and you move it around, and your partner has to follow your hand no matter where you go. And then you switch. And what always happens is the first person starts to take over, like, starts to, like, push the other person around a little bit and kind of get them into weird, awkward positions. And then when they switch... The person who had been, you know, quote unquote oppressed in the first half of the game
is not nice about it.
Oh my God. They always go, like, 10 times harder. They, like, push harder. And so that I always think of that when I see, cause, like, suddenly his role is reversed. He's no longer subservient to her. So that's kind of what I saw, is that, like, that initial kind of explosion of intensity of, like,
mm-hmm.
I'm in charge now. And it kind of, it fades away as the movie goes on. So, because I think if that attitude kept up the whole movie,
it would be
unbearable. Yeah, so we're at Sitka. We meet his family, including Coach and Mary Steenburgen and Betty White.
Also, Betty White is the best.
And Betty White is Gammy. And so everyone's kind of brutal to her because he calls his family a lot and complains about his horrible boss. So... Everyone's a little like, all right.
Spawn of Satan.
Yeah. So he basically says, like, we're going to tell my parents we're engaged when I want. And his dad immediately confronts him about it, about bringing her here and, like, what is he doing and blah, 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 blah. His dad's kind of an ass. And he just immediately kind of was like, hey, we're engaged. Right? And so, like.
And then we get, I feel like, what is a really good version of the trying to improv a story at the same time game.
Mm-hmm.
Because they get asked about what was the proposal like.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's awkward and it's annoying, but in a good way. Like, it's written and acted really well, because it does sound, like, with all the asides, it sounds like the sort of When Harry Met Sally story that you've told 84 times, but we know that they are just barbing at each other.
Yeah, each time they take over this story, they change it on the other person a little bit, and they're like, it's combative, but it's also coherent.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this really kind of smart, fun little moment.
But I also think that it, I don't know if it's intentional, but it feels to me like an interesting comment on the trope of everyone in relationships actually hates each other and hates each other's idiosyncrasies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you, or even if you don't, you're supposed to act like you do. So you're supposed to be like, you know, oh, he's such a wuss, or he's such a manly man and doesn't know how to do the laundry, and she is such a harridan and all this stuff, which, I don't know if it's an intentional thing, but it feels like, because nobody reacts to the fact that they are so harsh to each other, because it's like, oh, they're just kidding. Everyone kids in mean ways about their partner.
Yeah. It's fun. It's an interesting dynamic they set up with them. And then, of course, we get the sleeping arrangements for the night, and Mary Steenburgen is like, oh, we're under no pretense that you don't sleep in the same bed. Here, you can share this room. And
which is, again, such a good way to set it up.
Yeah. Of like, no. I insist you both share this room. And then Gammy's like, also take this blanket. We call it the baby maker. Which is like, I love it.
And which then proceeds to, like, be Sandra Bullock's, I don't know, monkey paw returning telltale heart something. Like, she just cannot get away from this blanket.
Yeah. Yeah, so we get them kind of sharing a room. Gammy has a little puppy who she's like, don't let him outside. The eagles will get him. Of course, she takes the phone call, goes outside. And this is, at this point, Jenna's like, oh no. Is the eagle going to get the dog? And she was actually like terrified that this was going to happen. I was like, it's a rom-com. They're not going to murder a dog 40 minutes into a rom-com.
The eagle does get the dog, but the dog is okay.
The dog's okay. We get
and
like...
She throws her phone at the eagle.
Yeah.
The eagle drops the dog, but not because of the phone, just because the dog is heavy, I think. And then it sees the glinting phone and takes the phone, and she's running around trying to like...
Trying to offer the dog.
Eagle the dog back, which is just so funny. I mean, it's not funny, but it is funny. Because it's like, she is panicked because she's talking to this huge author. She's just like, it makes perfect, you can see like it makes perfect sense in her head where she's like, well, it can't hold both the dog and the phone. So if I make the dog accessible.
Indiana Jones this dog into its talons somehow. But yeah, so at the party where they're at also, I forgot to mention, Oscar from The Office is there as a caterer.
I was fully expecting her to go into allergic shock because there was going to be pine nuts in it. Because they bring up at one point that she's allergic to pine nuts.
Oh,
like, it's
yeah,
one of the questions
right.
that they discuss from the INS yeah. questionnaire. I was, again, completely fully expecting her to go into full anaphylactic shock, or at least, like, swell up in a very charming, classic rom-com way, you know? But she doesn't.
Yeah.
It is Chekhov's pine nuts, and they are not put to use.
I know, yeah. A lot of stuff doesn't come back. But I think that's also just to showcase how much he knows about her. And so, yeah, then the next day, Mom and Grandma take Margaret to a bar for a bachelorette party where Oscar is a stripper. And also at that bar, Margaret learns that one of the people that she's met is Andrew's ex-girlfriend from back in the day, and he had proposed to her, and she said no because she didn't want to leave Sitka, and he wanted to go to New York. So kind of learned that he'd been in this relationship, and his career is really important to him too.
And I kind of wonder too, because I do get the feeling that he really does care about his career, but with how his dad is, because I'm assuming just like his dad has been trying to force him into the family, like has been talking about this since he was like 12. Like, of yeah. course you're going to take over the Paxton family business, and he doesn't want it. It's something that they still fight about. And also the way that this family is so enmeshed and has no sense of like personal boundaries or integrity, that I'm wondering, did he want to go to New York, or did he just want to get away from Sitka? You know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And yeah, his dad is pretty brutal in this. Is this the point where the INS agent comes? Or is that later?
That's later.
Well, we get like wacky shenanigans. We get like he's doing naked yoga on the patio, and she's taking a shower, and he's listening to his music, and then they naked stumble into each other.
That slam is hilarious.
And like, this is like slow fall.
Yeah, and it is such a good example of like properly used nudity.
Yeah.
Because there's no male or female. Because like, yes, briefly, like Ryan Reynolds takes off his shirt, but really it's more about like you couldn't do this scene as well if they were like in their underwear. They slam into each other. It's really weird.
Sweaty and post shower, so they're also wet, which is like,
and it's just it's and because she is trying to find a towel, so she has like a scrub mitt over her privates and her arm over her boobs, and again, like, even just sort of how her movement and posture is choreographed is not meant to be sexy. It is, because they could have been like, oh, this is sexy funny or funny sexy, and it's not. It's, she's just like, what the hell am I supposed to do, right?
Yeah.
And I kind of appreciate that, you know?
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, and, you know, we just get, like, shenanigans. The family's like, you've got to get married here while you're here. Like, the whole family will be here. It'll be great.
Can I say, again, a thing that I really love in that scene? Because he's on the, you know, they get a knock at the door.
And they have to get in bed
and
together.
And they're like, oh, he has to hurry into bed. And she's like, what the hell? And he's like, it's morning. But it's not made a big deal of, which I, again, kind of appreciate. Where it's like, you know, it underlines how weird this situation is, but it's not actually like uncomfortable or unpleasant really for both of them. It's just like, well, that's weird, but they've already, you know, they also slam into each other naked. So it's just like, all right, it's basically like the rom-com premise of like, either I've seen you puke or poop yourself or break your leg or whatever, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, part of the humor of all of this comes from their reactions to each other. They are, angry and annoyed and disgusted and mortified every time they come into, like, even remotely close romantic contact or sexual contact.
And also have, like, half a second of, wait, what was that? And then, because this is an absurd situation for both of them. It's not that, it's not that one of them is, like, okay with it and enjoying it, which is, I think, also an interesting take on this trope. Because, like, he is not enjoying this. Like, briefly, like you said, in the beginning, he's enjoying, because he's like, I can, you know, make. And then he's like, well, I don't like this, because, like, his family gets really into it. So they are both hating the situation.
Yeah. So, yeah, we get, like, wacky shenanigans. We get the, you got to get married here. At some point, dad calls INS and basically, like, reports him because he thinks that his son is.
Yeah, which is funny, like, yeah, because he's like, oh, he's being taken advantage of. Which he is.
Right, which he is.
I will say, not as badly as, because for a second, when she's like, you know, you'll never work again. And I'm like, is she really threatening him? But she just, like, sets it up as a practical thing. Like, Bob will fire him and everything will be over. Because for a second, I'm like, ooh, that is not romantic at all. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, she is taking advantage of him. And, you know, you kind of get the sense also somewhere in there that, you know, he is kind of a romantic in some ways and, like, family matters to him. So, like, having a divorce behind him won't be nothing to him, even if he knows it was a fake one, you know?
Right. So, yeah, once the family is like, hey, you guys got to get married while you're here, Margaret kind of has this, like, realization of, like, I like this family. I don't want to hurt them.
She lost her parents when she was 16. So we get, again, the whole thing of, like, I've never had a family and I really like this one. And the struggle of, like, well, I get to be part of it now, and I don't want to hurt them with a fake relation. I don't want to lie to them anymore.
Yeah, and we get this, like, confrontational confession in a boat where they're both kind of, like, confessing their challenges in their lives and kind of coming clean with each other a little bit. And then, of course, she falls out the boat. She can't swim. He saves her. And then we get to the wedding. Everyone's there, and Margaret.
Well, before that, they also, like, confess some difficulties, like, in the bedroom, but from different parts of the room, which is, like, in a fairly sweet scene, I think.
Yeah.
Where you can see, like, he's being moved. She's trying to sort of make him comfortable because she has got to hear some of his stupid stuff, kind of thing.
Yeah. Oh, and I also totally forgot the whole Betty White in the woods. I glossed right over that part.
Yeah, she's doing some, because she has to get away because she's like, no, this is nice. I don't like this. So she, like, steals a bike and wobbles off into the woods. And she runs into Betty White, who's doing some kind of, I think she's thanking Mother Nature for bringing them together, or Mother Earth for bringing them together.
I think that's what it is.
I'm assuming also, like, you know, trying to preach up a baby or something. I don't know. Like, incant up a baby for the two of them, all that stuff, because he's the only child. And it's really hard to explain how she starts singing Get Low, and I kind of don't even want to spoil it in case someone has forgotten. I want you all to watch this movie again just for that scene. But, well, I love it. I love it. Yeah. It's so stupid. And,
well, yeah. And we won't spoil it. Suffice it to say, it's an interesting, if also slightly problematic scene, and complicated to me by the fact that when she's in the immigration office at the very beginning, she says, I'm sure you have a room full of like busboys and gardeners to deal with.
Yeah,
and
that was,
like, ooh, she's racist.
Yes, there is. There's a lot of weirdness there. But it's, I think, also kind of a switching point for her, because, I mean, some parts of this are just beyond obvious, where it's like, oh, in the beginning she's wearing, like, stiletto Manolo Blahniks, and her hair is very severely scraped back, and then slowly her hair is let down. She switches to, like,
she chills out,
ballerina slippers. And I think this is also where, like, she is unhappy and confused and is not fully in on this little dance chant exercise, and then she's like finds the only way she can relate to this.
Yeah.
Which, like, and then she's doing this very bad, weird butt wiggle dance.
Yeah. And then, so we won't spoil any more of that. But jump ahead to the wedding. The INS agent is there, of course,
wedding. It's so funny that he's, like, a guest.
Yeah. And she basically has, like, the crisis of conscience where she says, I can't go through with this. This is a sham. I'm so sorry. And then the guy's like, well, all right, you got 24 hours to head to Canada.
And it's so bizarre because she's doing the, like, I can't do this basically because I love you is both implied and then stated outright by other people later. But it's like, you don't know that he won't go to jail because you just did that. I would assume that, like, if she confesses that, she has then outed him for being part of a conspiracy to commit fraud against the U.S. government. Because he's like, well, no, it's really simple, since you came willingly. And it's like, that's not how crime works, right.
But it's also implied that the dad used his, you know, wealth or power or leverage to get a deal, you know.
But he only had 20 seconds to take that deal.
Yeah.
Because that's what I'm thinking, like, when she confesses, again, full on, while you were sleeping, I'm like, yes, on the one hand, that is very sweet. On the other hand, you don't know that you haven't just screwed him over royally. Also, a thing that occurred to me fairly early on is they have this booklet of all the INS questions. They're never seen touching it again. She has to learn all these things about him. How does he take his coffee? You know, what do their kitchen curtains look like? Like, all this stuff. They never touch it again.
That is part of my fix.
Okay, never mind. Sorry. never mind. But, sorry, I apologize.
No. But we're on the same page. She heads home to pack. He rushes home. She's already gone. She's left a note with the manuscript saying, like, I'll publish it. And he gets in a fight with his dad. And then his mom or grandma has a heart attack. Oh, no. We're airlifting to the hospital. She's like dying in the helicopter.
Asking them to make up.
And as she's like fading away, she like wakes up. She's like, oh, great. I feel a lot better. Thanks.
False alarm. Let's go to the airport instead.
Let's go to the airport since we're already in this helicopter. Cause she knows that he really loves Margaret. They get to the airport. She's already gone though, right?
They see the plane starting to
start. Yeah.
To leave, and he's like, oh crap.
Yeah, so he goes to New York and tells Margaret that he loves her.
And I'm like, go into the office, don't do this in public.
Oh, but the whole thing is like the whole staff who thinks she's a monster is like, okay. And they smooch, and they head to the INS office. They talk to the INS guy and they say, hey, we're engaged for real. But when he proposes, it's like, let's get engaged and start dating. Which is kind of the implicit end of Son-in-Law, too. It's like, we're going to head back and start our relationship for real. And so they head to the INS office. They say, hey, we're actually engaged. She's like, all right, let's do this. Question time. And then as the credits roll, we get a series of wacky questions and interviews with the other characters in the movie. It's very fun.
And
that's it.
And that's where I'm like, see, that's not how it works, because your visa has run out.
No, but it's a comedy, Julia.
I know, but I'm also like, because what they could do, and this is not necessarily a fix, but it's like, because she would have to go to Canada and apply for a fiancé visa from there.
Yeah.
If they're, like, reapplying. And I'm like, couldn't they, like, start a publishing house in Toronto? Like,
yeah, honestly, and get the, this is 2009. They have no idea what's coming 7 years down the line. They should go to Canada.
So we've been through, like, what are the tropes? Do we care about the main couple as people and as a couple?
Yeah, I do.
I like a lot of this movie and I like a lot of these characters, but I will get to some of my objections in my fix. But again, like, I just feel like the stakes are so harsh that it's kind of hard to cheer for them. And like, because they're in Alaska for, I think, 4 days, 3.5
something
days.
Like that. Yeah.
And it's only halfway through that they stop, like, hating each other. And I feel like something about that doesn't feel super right. And I think, actually, screw it. My fix, basically, is that she needs some redeeming qualities in relationship to him, and they need to have built up a friendship before. Because when he's like, 3 days ago, I hated you.
Yeah.
And, like, there's nothing to suggest anything about them, which makes it feel like this is just a trauma response. Like, he hates her. He is forced into this pretty brutal situation with high stakes and then the situation with the family. And I'm like, you're not in love. Your brain is just trying to handle this somehow. Whereas if it was either more like 2 weeks notice or a lot of other films where it's like, yes, she's like a bitch and she's very demanding, but they have some sort of rapport that is more than that, you know?
Yeah.
Where maybe she doesn't know that he's from Alaska, but like she knows some stuff about him, and they like have a little bit of a give and take, a little bit more. Plus, when she says that she blocked his manuscript because, like, it was good, but I knew that if it was published, then I would lose you as an assistant. You get, again, where it's like, yes, in a way, she's complimenting him, that he is talented and that he is, you know. But she's also blocking something really important professionally for him. That's not something you get over super easily.
Yeah, she's halting his career advancement.
And I feel like a few of those things need to be tamped down and or switched over to where, like, again, she's super demanding, but they actually like each other. Because otherwise it just feels like a trauma response and not a good way to start a relationship. So that's my fix already, but I needed to bring up that when you talk about them, because it makes it harder to cheer for them, for me.
Yeah, that's fair. That's totally fair. I like them. I think I like them on the merits of their actors more than anything.
Yeah, they're charming enough to make this work.
Yeah.
I feel like the side characters do a lot for this movie.
Yeah. I mean, Oscar's very fun. And Betty White. Yeah, Betty White is great. I have a challenge with the native aspect of this film.
For that matter, the fact that Ramon, or Oscar, as you prefer to call him, is I was going to say the only person of color with a speaking role, but no, because the guy that he spills coffee on also gets to say, "Why do you want my shirt?" basically.
Yeah.
But he's definitely the only person of color in Sitka or Alaska. I don't know.
Yeah.
And the only character of any note of color in this movie.
Yeah. I mean, that to me is like, I love Betty White. I haven't yet like internally unpacked like the racial implications of this movie, because I know they're there and I know they're big. And also, it deals with immigration in a way that is safe, quote unquote, because she's Canadian.
Mm-hmm. And right? Even they talk about that. It's not like I'm a real immigrant. I'm Canadian.
Right.
And it's like, oof, that is not great. But I will say, though, that because it would have been really easy for this movie to just be like a joke about basically like, you know, my grandma was an Inuit princess, Cherokee princess style. But they do talk about an actual First Nations affiliation. They talk about an actual specific person who is, I think, only two generations back for Betty White. Like, there's an actual story there. It's not just like either she has picked up on Native traditions as a white woman or this vague story about Native blood in the family, which a lot of white families have, you know? So right. At least there is something, like, they acknowledge that. They acknowledge the specific, her specific people and that language. It's not as sort of sweeping and dismissive as it could be. And I want to be clear here. I say this as not just a non-Native person, but as a non-American person. Like, this is coming from my perspective as someone who is, like, academically interested in this, but may miss a lot of the subtleties just as a white, not American, right?
Yeah.
Not North American, I should say.
Yeah, and to me, it's complicated a little bit by, like, I don't think that Betty White has any Native heritage as a actor, so, like, that complicates that role a little bit. She's great, and I just wonder, like, were there ways to do this without that? Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, she could have just been, like, a weird...
A hippie, like...
Yeah, exactly, like a hippie, witchy woman type person.
Yeah.
And I don't know if like, they tried to do representation and not humor. You know, they, like, if they intentionally wanted it, like, we do want to acknowledge that Alaska is not, you know, just...
Not as white as this movie would have us
believe. Yeah, not just Kennedy's.
Yeah. Not as white and as wealthy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's ironic, too. The other night, I watched Insomnia at like 3 a.m. because the baby was crying, and I was like, well, I'm going to watch Insomnia while I'm awake. And that also takes place in Alaska. And like one of the characters comments about like, there are two people who live in Alaska, people who are born here or people who came here to get away from something. Right. And so there's this idea that Alaska is this kind of refuge for people with shady pasts or with kind of history that they don't want to return to for whatever reason.
Or people who are like, we might have COVID. Let's go to Alaska to get away from LA. Yeah. And then the Alaskans are like, no, you're not. Go away. No.
But yeah, there's elements of that I wish this movie addressed as well. Like, this is a very Leave It to Beaver-y version of Alaska And
which could be like fairly true and representative, because what money does is it buys you, you know, the privilege of turning a blind eye or not even realizing what you're not seeing.
Yeah.
Did I mention before that this is both a very stupid and a very academic podcast? Yes. Yes, it is. Do you have a favorite character?
I mean, it's probably Betty White.
Mm-hmm.
With that asterisk around the character choices, but mm-hmm. But she's just great.
She's same. My least favorite character is actually Ramon, because he is way too aggressive about everything. Like sticking your fingers into someone's mouth with food. He's way too close physical. And in a way that would make me incredibly uncomfortable. And it's like, yes, the joke is like, oh, they go to a strip club and he's the only exotic dancer they have. And it's very classic scene of like, he gets too up close and personal and she doesn't like it. But he's always too close and too much in a way that is a little too creepy to still be funny. You know?
That's fair.
Do you have a least favorite character?
It's Dad.
Yeah, but he's meant to be. Like,
yeah, he's kind of the villain and I get it. But yeah, he's my least favorite.
Do you have a favorite part?
I think that like the naked smush is probably my favorite.
Smush is a very good.
And then, you know, I love that right after that she's like goes to grab a blanket or something to cover up, and the first thing she grabs is the baby maker.
And then she's like, "Oh
no, not the baby maker!"
And I love that she is also a little superstitious about it.
Yeah,
you know that she's just like, "All right, well." Yeah, I think the forest sweat drop down my balls, just because it makes me laugh. I know it's not completely unproblematic, but it makes me laugh. The naked smush is funny. It has a lot of like funny little scenes in a way that makes it hard to pick one that you're like, yes, that's it.
Yeah, it is full of very delightful little moments like throughout this movie. Like the plot is very simple and straightforward, but there's a lot of like cute and clever and charming stuff packed in it.
I think my least favorite part is when the dad and the INS agent are like, when the dad is like, we're not going to mention this to your mother. And he has just like assumed what the truth is. I mean, you're not wrong about what the truth is, but either way. And the INS agent, because I'm like, that it's just, again, it's so unpleasant. And also I'm like, I don't think this is a thing INS agents do.
Yeah.
Because INS agents, yes, in theory, you know, but if you think about it, they don't want people to be in a country that don't legally have a right to be there, but they also don't want people to help those people. So I don't, anyway, I just, that it's a little too unpleasant for me. And with the end, I think maybe we've already covered it. Like the end credits with the questions are kind of cute.
Even if they're inaccurate.
Well, I mean, the questions are probably pretty accurate, but more of a, like, well, now everything is fine. She can stay and keep her job. We're like, no. But I think you have the big impassioned speech, and then he gets to have a big impassioned speech. And,
yeah.
What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I like it. It's charming. And I think, like, watching those actors get to kind of clearly improv through those questions at the end is fun. Because, you know, they're funny actors.
Yeah. So on Rotten Tomatoes, this has a 44% fresh rating from critics, 67% from audiences, and an exactly matching 6.7 on IMDb. Well, what would you give this? How many Sandra Bullocks out of 10?
I'd probably give it like 7. Like same. Yeah, I like it. I like it a lot. It's very charming. It's very funny. It has enough about it that is a little squicky and icky for me that it that holds it back from being a great movie. And I think
Is it Despicable Me 3 was like, I like it, but not a lot.
Yeah, it's like that, you know, and there are certain choices that I'm like, I wonder why they made that choice. And also like even with Ramon, I like the character, but he's also like carrying a lot of racial stereotypes along with him. You know, so there's, you know, this movie has kind of a whiteness problem, but I recognize that I still enjoy a lot of the humor and I enjoy the relationship and I enjoy the actors.
Yeah, and I will say also, like, the things that feel a little problematic now, probably most of them felt problematic then, too, if you know what I mean.
Oh,
it's not that it's, like, aged badly.
I remember feeling that way when I saw it.
Yeah, it's just like originally. It has a few too many conventions that are not great, and the classic of like, well, we can't you know, you can't make a woke rom-com, which you can, you very much can.
Yeah.
So, like, it doesn't have things that specifically feel like super icky now with 12 years of hindsight, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, we already went over my fix. I just feel like she needs some redeeming qualities. They need to have some sort of friendly relationship for this to not feel. Yeah. And also, like, again, I get that we need the stakes to be super high, but they are pretty brutal.
Oh, yeah. And my fix is really, like, that idea that they have to learn about each other. She doesn't really learn about him until that boat ride.
Mm-hmm.
She learns about his family. But, like, I would love a montage.
But even then, she doesn't know anything about the things that they will ask you.
Right.
How does he take his coffee? Which is funny because he gets her coffee. It would be funny if she's like, well, cinnamon, non-fat soy latte, I guess.
Yeah.
That would be a fun callback.
I just want a montage in here of her getting to, like, learning things about him from the book.
By rote.
Yeah. But, like, seeing it all in action as well. So you get, like, mm-hmm. it's not just quizzes, but it's, like, physical. Like, you get physical comedy. You get to, like, you know, and them kind of trying on this engagement a little bit more.
It would be funny, too, if we see how she discovers things. Where it's, like, some movies where it's just, like, all these little things happen that you don't necessarily take note of, but then later somebody can either answer questions or perform a certain task where it's like she would, you know, see a certain picture and then they would talk about that one time he caught a salmon with his bare hands or whatever. And yeah. Then randomly those would be the only questions that the INS guy asks.
Yeah.
So they would be super anxious about the fact that they forgot to learn all these questions, but just randomly from being there for 2 days, she learns about, like, what sports he played as a kid or, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, we made it sort of better, I think. It's pretty...
Yeah.
Can we make it weird? Because with like, how weirdly enmeshed this family is, like, you can tell, like, he has not grown up with any sense of, like, his own space or boundaries or integrity. Like, you know, they storm in, they, like, get married, everything. And also the fact that, as you pointed out, it's light all the time. I'm like, so this is Midsommar, Alaska.
Oh, my God.
So it's just, like, it's this cult family. Because, like, you know, they own and control the whole town. And he has made it out alive. And, like, Gertrude was possibly going to be sacrificed because she wasn't allowed to marry into the Paxtons, but it was okay. So there's just this weird, brutal... And then I was like, is Ramon the cult leader? Or is he infiltrating it for the CIA? Or is he just, like, this... I don't know. But just, like, that this whole... Little island community is just this weird, bizarre cult, and, like, everybody just disappears. And, like, I don't know if they're going to sacrifice someone to give Gammy 10 more years of life. Possibly, I would like that.
Oh, but my just God. Like,
just that
it's so good.
Yeah, and because also people do weird stuff when they haven't slept. I don't know if you've heard of that.
Yeah.
So Midsommar Alaska edition is basically
I absolutely love that. Mine is kind of similar in that, again, I just watched Insomnia, which is all about Al Pacino going to Alaska, and it's bright out, and he can't sleep, but it's also, like, he's racked with guilt. It's a little telltale heart. So I was thinking, well, what if Sandra Bullock is also racked with guilt for this situation? They do play very briefly with the idea that it is always light out, and she can't sleep because it's light, and then they have, like, magic shades that darken the room. But, what if she gets insomnia and starts to kind of, like, hallucinate and lose her mind a little bit, and it transitions from this, like, rom-com, but about halfway through it becomes this, like, horror thriller. So I guess, like, kind of, I don't know why we both took this into, like, this dark.
Because we both experienced Eternal Day.
Yeah. That's it. I didn't have details on it, but I wanted to see what would happen.
I think we can smush those two together pretty well.
Yeah.
And, like, so it is a cult, but she also can't tell what's real and what's not because she's hallucinating.
Oh, my God. That's what it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
both. Starts... Like, she's freaking out, but then she's, like, can't tell because she's also hallucinating, like, completely harmless things.
Yeah. Oh, it's great.
Oh, God. What did we learn from this movie? I think I learned that it is really interesting when fluff has really brutal stakes.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I like it, but it's interesting. Like, it's an unusual thing to do.
Yeah.
What about you?
I learned that it's not really I learned, but I reappreciated how much I love Betty White.
Mm-hmm. Next week, we will unfortunately, be talking about 9 months. You can find our show notes. I will link to some interesting stuff about, again, different words for Native and First Nation peoples. You can find everything at theincomparable.com/chickflickfix. We are Chick Flick Fix on Twitter and Instagram. Give us a ping and feel free to call us in if you feel like we messed stuff up. We will be back next week. Say goodbye, AJ.
Goodbye, AJ.